the bad news from Washington and the cool news from New York, I do hear, like here locally, hope that we can have a good resolution to this that treats our people fairly, because there's no county without the workers.
2% raise they're offered?
I mean, it's just, it's crazy. So yeah. Maybe somebody heard this and, you know, maybe we'll play a small part in resolving it, but
we'll hope,
I won't
let's
hold
hope so.
My
let's
breath.
Hope so. All right. As our predecessor, Mr. John Lee Johnson, used to say, stay out of trouble. But as Paul Muth, John Lewis, Aaron Ammons like to say, let's get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you. Stay tuned for news from Neptune.
The furthest out planet. I like to say, oh, you got a picture of Chomsky just to bless my soul.
Hey, that's to bless your soul.
That's where the name of the show comes from. He was dismissed as being from Neptune because he doesn't talk... in sound bites, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your chapeau. Let's see. When we have a Jamal's got some longer pieces out that are pretty fresh. I think I played one of them about music on just before on my show last Sunday. I won't be getting to it today. And Amy's got a very potent commentator. We'll start with that, as we typically do, if I don't have something fresh from Mumia that fits in the schedule. Amy Goodman had a web exclusive with a woman who was on primarily to talk about this idiocy of, was it Tennessee that's defunding Planned Parenthood? I can't remember. A major healthcare provider in a lot of the areas, while they're going to take a hatchet to the rural hospitals. Astonishing times. So I haven't done anything about reproductive autonomy in a bit, so I'm glad to bring this segment to the air. The other two pieces I mentioned, I foreshadowed when I called in on Higher Ground earlier, was about public health and the idiocy and the perfidy, the lying, to use the Anglo-Saxon, of RFK. There's a lot of turmoil about it. This is Peter Offit, who engaged RFK in debates through the years, primarily about this allegation that vaccines cause autism. But so Peter Offit's been on a fair amount through the last week, and there have been some developments, but he sort of lines out this coup that was done where after promising to that Republican senator from Louisiana, is it Kennedy, who's a doctor, getting a promise from him that he wasn't going to manipulate the vaccine board, advisory board. Well, he done it. And I'm sure Kennedy's taking some flack, and a call to him from outside his state might be an interesting thing to do if you want to vent. Already 4 minutes into the show, so... Well, why don't I play Smedley Butler, just because we're coming up on the 4th of July. That seems like a good idea around any national holiday when the military is highlighted. It's good to hear from whom I've been calling my favorite veteran.
I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies. In China, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best that he could do was operate his racket in 3 districts. I operated on 3 continents. War is a racket. It always has been. A few profit and the many pay. But there is a way to stop it. You can end it by disarmament conferences. It can be smashed effectively only by taking the profit out of war.
Okay. I believe that was the original VFW address that Butler made. Quite a man. He was in all those places, was involved in China and during the Boxer Rebellions, too. There's a good book by Katz, I can't remember his first name, called Gangster of Capitalism. Okay, let's try and stay on the timeline here with Amy Goodman talking about those masked men. Stephen Miller's henchmen, I guess.
Time to unmask Trump's detention and deportation squads. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. With each passing day, the violence wielded by ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement grows more intense and widespread. One grotesquely emblematic example of this was the recent violent arrest of 48-year-old Narciso Branco in Santa Ana, California. Narciso, a hard-working immigrant laborer who came from Mexico over 30 years ago, is the father of three U.S. Marines. While landscaping outside an IHOP restaurant June 21st, he was assaulted by at least seven armed, masked men who tackled him and repeatedly punched him in the head. They handcuffed him and shoved him into an unmarked SUV. The plainclothes agents wore face masks, bulletproof vests, and military-grade helmets. Some of the vests read, "Police, U.S. Border Patrol," on the back, but to anyone confronted by these gangs, no identifying marks, names, or badges were visible. One of Narciso's sons, Alejandro Branco, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, was able to visit his father in jail. Narciso was still wearing the same work clothes that were bloodied in the assault.
He looked beat up. He looked rough. He looked defeated. He was sad.
Alejandro said on the Democracy Now! News Hour.
Anybody would be scared if they see these guys come up to them masked, not in uniform, guns out.
City of Santa Ana Council member Jonathan Hernandez, also on Democracy Now!, added,
"We are watching the violence unfold. We are seeing racial profiling increase in cities like Santa Ana, where 41% of our residents are migrants, 70% are of Latino descent. The majority of those in the Latino community in Santa Ana are of Mexican descent, families like the Barranco family. Families like mine that migrated here from Mexico to Santa Ana. We have examples of you know, for one, over $100 million of taxpayer money here in Orange County is accredited to immigrant families, families like Mr. Barranco. And what we are seeing is unidentified agents come into our community, and they're refusing to identify themselves. They don't have judicial warrants, and these ICE raids are an example of the government's overreach."
In mid-June, President Trump briefly paused immigration raids on farms, hotels, and restaurants, ostensibly to ensure these key industries that have supported him in the past continue to do so. Quote, "Our great farmers and people in the hotel and leisure business have been stating that our very aggressive policy on immigration is taking very good long-time workers away from them, with those jobs being almost impossible to replace," Trump wrote. Soon after, he reversed himself. The short pause revealed a fundamental truth about undocumented immigrants. The U.S. economy doesn't function without them. Nevertheless, urged on by White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, ICE, Homeland Security, and border agents are snatching and deporting the very workers on whom our economy depends. There are some sectors of the economy that are thriving amidst the mass deportations. GEO Group, the private prison corporation, has seen its stock rise by over 50% since Trump's election. Palantir, the tech and AI firm co-founded by Trump backer billionaire Peter Thiel, has seen its stock rise over 500% in the past year. It was recently reported Palantir is building tools to allow near real-time tracking of immigrants in the U.S. The Program on Government Oversight, POGO, reported Stephen Miller's financial disclosure reveals he owns up to $250,000 in Palantir stock. Meanwhile, the Republican majority on the U.S. Supreme Court has handed Trump a deportation-related victory. Several immigrants sued the government to stop or reverse deportations to Guatemala, South Sudan, and Libya. A federal judge in Massachusetts issued an injunction against these so-called third-party nation removals. This week, the Supreme Court's six conservative justices overturned that injunction without comment. Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson dissented, writing that the Trump administration's, quote, flagrantly unlawful conduct, unquote, backed by the Supreme Court is, quote, exposing thousands to the risk of torture or death, unquote. Resistance is active, growing, and making a difference. Grassroots pressure and legal battles have won the release of international students targeted for their solidarity with Palestinians, among them Tufts student Rumaysa Ozturk, Columbia graduate Mohsen Madawi, and the first such student arrested and threatened with deportation, Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil. Likewise, grassroots legal and congressional pressure forced the Trump administration to bring Kilmar Abrego Garcia back to the United States. The Maryland father received asylum during Trump's first term in 2019 based on credible threats from an El Salvador gang. Then this past March 12th, he was snatched from a parking lot and sent against a court order to El Salvador. Under enormous legal and grassroots pressure, the federal government finally returned Abrego Garcia to the U.S. Despite that victory, upon his return, the federal government promptly rearrested him, charging him with human trafficking for allegedly driving undocumented immigrants several years ago. He remains in federal custody in Tennessee, and if released, ICE will likely attempt to deport him. Meanwhile, Narciso Branco sits in ICE detention, with his two sons still on active duty in the U.S. Marines not far away at Fort Pendleton. It's past time to unmask the violent agents targeting people like Narciso and halt Trump's racist, xenophobic mass detentions and deportations. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Diseases.
Oh, yes. Brian Edwards Tekert. He's on holiday, so I actually have something for Corona Calls with another favorite producer of mine at KPFA, Philip Maldery. 12 minutes and counting. Let's see how we're doing here. Let's get to the web exclusive. Again, this guest was on talking on the air, on the regular broadcast, about pulling Planned Parenthood funding I believe it's Tennessee. We'll hear that, I'm sure, in the introduction. So this is the segment that didn't get on the air. Important subject I haven't treated in a while, too, the reproductive autonomy, as I like to call it, for women. Let's see. Underwriting announcement? Let's see. Support human needs, not corporate greed.
Programming at WEFT is supported in part by Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County and the Habitat Restore. When you donate, volunteer, or shop at the Habitat Restore, you're invested in building homes, communities, and hope throughout Champaign County. Learn more about Habitat for Humanity of Champaign at cuhabitat.org or follow them on Facebook and Instagram.
Indeed. Thank you, Thursday Morning Jazz. Okay, here's segment I introduced, and if I'm sounding a little breathless, maybe it's just because I am. I'm hanging around for Radio Free Labor, still grieving the passage of Bob Pelizny. It's still hard to believe. If you haven't done the WEFT app yet, do it now, because there's a little short blues clip with a picture of Bob that pops up, so maybe you don't know him by name, you just know him from his Sweet and Savory Blues show on Thursdays. Going to be hard to fill that in, too. Did such a great show. But yeah, I'm hoping Stephanie's here, too, because Gus and Stephanie will carry the weight of the show, I'm hoping, because I'm world weary.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 3 years ago this week, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. In 2023, the first lawsuit after the decision was filed by five women. They sued Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risks to their health and were non-viable. This is one of those plaintiffs, Amanda Zarofsky.
I cannot adequately put into words the trauma and despair that comes with waiting to either lose your own life, your child's life, or both. For days, I was locked in this bizarre and avoidable hell. In a matter of minutes, I went from being physically healthy to developing sepsis, a condition in which bacteria in the blood develops into infection with the ability to kill in under an hour.
Amanda Zarofsky talking about what happened to her with Texas's abortion ban. Well, she was on Capitol Hill this week, 3 years after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and its Dobbs decision, as part of a group of over 100 women who call themselves abortion storytellers, speaking with lawmakers as well as speaking publicly about their experiences. We continue our conversation now with Rebecca Grant, author of the new book, Access, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. In part one of our discussion at democracynow.org, we talked about the Supreme Court decision to back efforts by South Carolina to defund Planned Parenthood by removing its health clinics from the state's Medicaid program, a 6-3 decision. But now we want to go more deeply into Rebecca Grant's book, Access. Again, the subtitle, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. In part one, Rebecca, we started to talk about some of the heroines in your book. But if you can take us back, why you go back 60 years to talk about abortion in this country, how it's been dealt with. But your story of the resistance is global.
Yes, I decided to start the book in 1965 because I was really interested in what the activism looked like for, you know, people fighting for abortion rights, people fighting for abortion access in the years before Roe. And, you know, there was, of course, lobbying efforts and people who were focused on politics and the courts. But what I found, which really resonated with a lot of the current day reporting that I've been doing, was that there were also a lot of feminist activists who were more focused on trying to make accessing abortion safer. And so, you know, certainly before Roe, we continue to hear a lot about this idea of back alley clinics. I mean, women would really take their lives into their hands when they sought illegal abortions. They didn't know if the providers were adequately trained, if they were using clean or safe materials, if they would be attacked or robbed as part of the process. And so, you know, complications from unsafe abortion were rampant. Hospitals had wards called infected OB because it was such a big problem. And so there was these feminist activists who thought, okay, what can we do to make abortion safer? And so that looked a bunch of different ways. Like some of them created a vetted catalog of abortion providers that they could refer women to. The Janes, as they became known in the Chicago area, ultimately taught themselves how to perform abortions. And they helped about 12,000 women access abortion in the years leading up to Roe. Other activists helped kind of innovate on an early abortion procedure that was much less invasive and something that lay women could do amongst themselves. And so I really wanted to capture what that form of activism looked like in the years leading up to Roe, and then how it sort of disappeared after Roe, because we had legal abortion, we had clinics in this country. And then now after Dobbs, we're seeing the resurgence of these types of underground forms of activism, although it looks very different in some ways because we have access to medication abortion, to abortion pills now.
Now, that's absolutely key, this double pill abortion medication protocol. And what I was so struck by when I saw you in New York, when you did your first book reading and conversation, was the fact that post-Dobbs, and tell us why it's called Dobbs, but post-Dobbs, post the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, abortions have increased in this country, even as state after state imposes increasingly draconian abortion bans.
I think the fact that abortions have gone up in the wake of Dobbs is really a testament to the incredible resilience and determination and courage of the abortion access movement. And I think a lot of that, those increases have been driven by the fact that abortion is now much more accessible because of telemedicine abortion care than it ever was before. And so during the pandemic, during COVID, the FDA changed its regulations. It previously had stated that mifepristone, which is the first drug as part of the two-part protocol, could not be mailed outside of kind of, there was some studies that were looking at the efficacy of telemedicine abortion. But for most people, you couldn't legally go to an online resource, be evaluated by a clinician, and have them send you the medication in the mail. You had to pick the medication up at a brick and mortar clinic. And so that entailed all of the barriers that going to access a procedural abortion would. People would have to drive many hours, they would have to take time off work, they would have to find childcare, they would have to figure out accommodation if they were seeking abortion in a state that had a mandatory waiting period. And so abortion was already very inaccessible for large parts of the country before Dobbs. And what mailing did was said that, you know, if this is a good fit for you, for, you know, based on your eligibility, you can receive these pills pills at home, and they're a very safe and effective way to end your pregnancy. And so now, you know, a couple years after Dobbs and kind of in the wake of COVID, one in five abortions that happen across the country are happening via telemedicine. And so that sort of has been, I think, a really important factor. And then also the way that the kind of abortion fund movement has really stepped up to help people travel out of state for abortion care in increasingly significant ways. So abortion funds have been around since the 90s, and they've been doing really critical work ever since then. But between 2020 and 2023, the rates of people traveling out of state for abortions have doubled. And abortion funds are dispensing tens of millions of dollars, although many of them are struggling with funding as well. And so I think that it's also a testament to this entire ecosystem that was just like, we're not going to accept this. You know, an abortion ban does not mean that people can't access abortions, and we're going to figure out whatever we can do to ensure that they can do that safely.
So tell us how it was figured out that mifepristone and misoprostol, talk about these two drugs and how they ended up being used for abortion. And this is where the story goes global.
Yes. So mifepristone was developed. It was developed in France in the 1980s, and it was really developed with the intention that it would be a drug that could interrupt an early pregnancy. And so mifepristone has to be taken in conjunction with a drug that causes contractions. What mifepristone does is it sort of works as like a hormone blocker to prevent a pregnancy from continuing. And so while mifepristone was kind of being developed around the same time that it was approved in France, a group of kind of women on the ground, and there's sort of some myth around this, but there were women in Brazil, which had really high rates of maternal mortality and abortion complications, and abortion was banned. Lay women in Brazil started realizing that there was a drug called misoprostol, which had a warning on it on the box that said something along the lines of, do not take if pregnant or could cause miscarriage. And so through word of mouth and you know, some kind of like experimentation and discussions with pharmacists, Brazilian women realized that if they bought this over-the-counter ulcer medication, that they could safely and effectively manage their abortions outside of any kind of medical or legal system and without having to go to a clinic. And the effect of that and how this information spread by word of mouth was so significant that public health officials and doctors and hospitals in Brazil noticed a precipitous drop in complications from unsafe abortion. And so kind of over the years, awareness of the dual protocol of mifepristone plus misoprostol, which is sort of considered to be the kind of like the gold standard, the recommended World Health Organization protocol, that has become a norm for abortion provision. It now represents some 63%, I believe, of abortions in the U.S. But misoprostol can also be used on its own to provide an abortion. And since in many parts of the world and all over Latin America, misoprostol is available in pharmacies, all different forms of kind of underground word of mouth, peer-to-peer networks sprung up to help people access abortions just with the misoprostol alone.
Talk about the movement in Mexico.
Yeah, so in the book, one of the main characters is an activist named Veronica Cruz, who goes by Vero, and she started organizing around, you know, really focusing on abortion quite a lot around the year 2000, when the state that she lived in, Guanajuato, was the government was trying to remove one of the very limited exceptions that it had to its abortion ban, and so Vero was part of the effort to stop that change from going into effect, and they were successful, and so that meant that rape victims were able to legally access an abortion in the state, and so Vero started hearing from women who had been raped and were looking for abortion care, and she found an OBGYN who she could take them to, who was willing to provide them with procedural abortions at first. But then when that OBGYN learned about medication abortion, she started providing the patients with the medication, and then Vero saw that and thought, like, I could do this. It's not that complicated. You just ask them, you know, kind of evaluation questions, and here's explain the protocol and let people know what to expect. And so Vero went on to develop what's known as the accompaniment model, where women are sort of provided support and told that they can go to the pharmacy and purchase these medications. And then if they have leftover pills, which they often would because the boxes usually had 28 and they only needed 12 to 16 pills, they could pass their extras on to the next person who needed abortion support. And in addition to helping with the medication, they could provide emotional guidance and sort of, you know, support that way. And so then the people who came to seek help ended up being drawn into the movement, and they went on to help other people. And so in this very organic way, this accompaniment model spread all over Mexico. And in 2021, when the Mexican Supreme Court ruled in a decision to decriminalize abortion in the country, it referenced kind of the accessibility of medication abortion and the accompaniment model as one of the factors.
And then there's Dr. Rebecca Gompers. Tell us her story, Rebecca.
Dr. Rebecca Gompers is a Dutch doctor, and she is the founder of an organization. Her first organization was called Women on Waves, and it was started with this really radical idea, which was that she and her team would sail boats off the shore of countries that had abortion bans, starting in Europe, and they would find abortion seekers, or they would be contacted by abortion seekers, and they would then take those abortion seekers out into international waters where the national laws didn't apply, but rather the laws of the Netherlands where the boat was flagged to, and they would provide them with medication abortions at sea. And so she did this. The first campaign that she launched was to Ireland, although they were not able to provide medication abortions at the time because there were some sort of legal questions. But then a couple years later, she did a campaign to Poland, and they successfully provided medication abortion to, I believe it was about a dozen women. And, you know, these were very kind of media catnip campaigns, but really what they were meant to do was to raise awareness about the issue, to raise awareness about medication abortion, and to, in this really kind of powerful and subversive way, you know, subvert these abortion bans. And so Women on Waves in 2005, 2006, after doing Women on Waves for a couple years, Dr. Gompertz realized that she wanted to be able to support more women on a larger global scale, because Women on Waves, while, you know, attracted a lot of attention, ultimately was only able to provide abortions to a couple dozen women. And so she launched a global telemedicine service in 2006 called Women on Web. And that was really the first telemedicine service for abortion. And she helped, you know, I think over 100,000 people have accessed abortion care through Women on Web over the years. And in 2018, she created a third organization called Aid Access, which was really meant to bring the Women on Web model of global telemedicine abortion to the U.S. And this was before medication abortion could be mailed. And so it was kind of the first time in the U.S. that people could just go to a website and, you know, do the evaluation and receive that medication. And so today, Aid Access is one of the, or arguably, I guess, the kind of leading provider of medication abortion to all 50 states. And they work with Shield Law providers who are clinicians in blue states. And the most recent numbers that I saw are that they're providing around I think it's like 7,700 medication abortions a month, which is pretty impressive.
And explain exactly, Rebecca Grant, what that means. And that goes to, among others, Dr. Linda Prine here in New York. If you could tell us more about her and the kind of work that she does, how people get in touch with these doctors through telemedicine, something that really blossomed during the pandemic.
Yeah, so, you know, Aid Access, I think, is the largest provider of the telemedicine abortion care by volume, although over the past couple of years, there have been many, many more practices that have sprung up. And so sometimes it could depend on the state that you live in and what the specific rules are and what options are available to you. But for Aid Access, people can go to the website and there's an online form and you know, you fill out the information, and then these licensed providers who are doctors and nurses and midwives, they will evaluate the prescriptions. And if someone is eligible, they will write those prescriptions and have them sent to the address that they want. And so it's a pretty creative, I think, way that or just yet another creative example of how providers and kind of the abortion rights movement has really stepped up to preserve access. And so, you know, these Shield laws were something that after Dobbs, when blue states were like, what can we do to protect abortion access, both within our states and also for people who are in other states that have abortion bans? And these Shield laws were passed that said that if there is a provider who's licensed in our state, let's say New York, and they write a prescription for someone who's in, let's say, Texas, that if Texas tries to sue or indict or bring criminal charges or go after these doctors, we won't participate. We won't cooperate in that. We will protect these clinicians. And so I think that certainly we can expect that these sort of interjurisdictional, interstate conflicts are going to be an arena for some legal fighting in the years to come. They have been an absolutely critical way that people have been able to access abortion over the past couple years.
And why haven't Republican legislatures cracked down harder on these abortion medication pills?
I mean, they've been trying. I think that they have been trying, and they will continue to try until they are successful, or if they're not, they'll probably just keep trying. I mean, I think if anything, Dobbs has revealed the extent of their persistence and determination. So, you know, there have been some lawsuits that have tried to challenge mifepristone. You know, Texas sued a New York Shield Law provider, and Louisiana has brought criminal charges against a Shield Law provider for sending medication abortion. And so, as I said before, I think that, you know, those could be some potential ways that through the courts that anti-abortion politicians are trying to restrict it. And then also, there's this very ongoing effort to challenge the science, the clearly established, you know, over 100 peer-reviewed studies that have said that medication abortion is safe. But now there's these efforts to kind of try to claim that mifepristone or medication abortion is much more dangerous than it actually is. And as part of that, you know, to have the FDA put tighter regulations on it or sort of, you know, revoke the regulations on it. And RFK Jr. had said that he was open to hearing more about whatever, you know, that report claimed to say. And so I think that there's a couple of vectors of attack at the state level, through the courts, and at, you know, at a federal level as well.
And talk about what happened in Poland.
In 2020, so early on when the world was shutting down because of the pandemic, there was a woman who I've interviewed, and her story is included in the book, and I also did an article about it a couple years ago, but her name was Anya, and she found herself pregnant, and she was in an abusive relationship, and she already had a small child at home, and the pregnancy made her incredibly ill. I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation, but she had hyperemesis gravidarum, but basically it meant that she was just violently sick. She was throwing up all the time, and so she wanted to end the pregnancy. But Poland is one of the few countries in Europe that had an abortion ban, and so she had to figure something else out. And many Polish women would travel abroad for abortion care. They would go to Germany, they would go to the UK, but because international borders were shutting down, that wasn't an option, and she also was too sick to travel. And so she reached out to kind of an activist group or network, and one of those activists, Justyna, she ended up she had a personal supply of medication abortion at her home, and she sent the package to this woman, Anya. And Anya's partner found it. He intercepted it. He reported it to the police. And so Justyna was, a year later in 2021, she was charged with aiding and abetting an abortion. And so I went to Poland to report on the last day, on the day that her sentencing came down in the trial. And she was the first activist in Europe to be indicted and then subsequently convicted of this type of crime. And so her case is still making its way through the Polish court system and the European court system. But it was a really kind of both a troubling development, but also a sign that, you know, anti-abortion politicians are not afraid to go after activists or anyone who they consider to be aiding and abetting an abortion.
Rebecca Grant, you spent a long time researching your book, Access, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. What gives you the most hope?
I have been incredibly excited and inspired and impressed by the resilience of people who are stepping up. And I think that there are some folks who have been in kind of reproductive rights, health and justice activism for a long time. And there are people who were incredibly galvanized and angered by the Dobbs decision and wanted to step up. But whether these are Shield Law providers like Dr. Linda Pryan, who you mentioned before, or they're some of the kind of underground community support pill distributors who I also profile in the book. I mean, these are people who are putting themselves on the line, who are taking risks, who are really kind of doing whatever they can to make sure that people have access to abortion in all 50 states in a way that I think it does give me a lot of hope, because I think for so long in the U.S., we've been so obsessed with, you know, what the law says and politics and the courts and rights. And I think to me, what these activists are saying is that, you know, they don't like those forces. The government does not get to determine if, when, or how you get pregnant. They do not get to determine what you do with your body or what you do with your family. It is not up to them. It is up to you. And we are going to do whatever we can to both help you and support you in your choices and also to subvert these laws that are incredibly unjust and harmful. And I just think that there's something a little bit that feels a little bit liberating and freeing about that idea of, like, the Trump administration can try to throw and these states can try to throw whatever they want. But there are these groups and these individuals operating who are just never going to let them win.
Rebecca Grant, author of the new book, Access, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. To see part one of our discussion, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, that was an unaired segment from Democracy Now! Web exclusive. The author had on the air talked about, again, I didn't check to see if it was Tennessee, but I'm pretty sure Tennessee is the state that's defunding all of Planned Parenthood's activities, including all of the health care they give that aren't related to abortion services. A lot of cultural offerings to divert yourself from this world of woe. There's a Nagoma African Festival 2025 going on. It started yesterday with some art exhibits at the Community Center for the Art and a percussion workshop. There's an award ceremony in the heat of the day, 2 to 4 this afternoon, at Spurlock Museum. And I don't know what cell that. No further information on that. It's NGOMA, African Festival, if you want to search for more information. I just clipped a picture from Instagram or somewhere. Public concert and dance at the parking lot on Lincoln Square Mall. This probably is sort of in the area where the Farmers Market is. A Ghanaian band with Come On Studios. Don't know about that. The Great Barima Quadroga from Burkina Faso doing Burkina Griot, solo guitar, brilliant player. Congolese music with, I don't think I'm going to say all of these names. I know Jean-Ré Baliketa on guitar, a singer and a player. Bienvenue Bukola, I guess I can say bienvenue. Welcome. And Afro D with Pete Shogun. That's a great show. They graced some of the Juneteenth festivals. And in fact, there was something that I missed in my hood in downtown Urbana last night, a celebration of Congo's Independence Day with about four bands, including Afro D. And I didn't make it to even a couple of tunes. Thinking about today, being tired and watching the Hannah Arendt documentary, which was pretty good. I didn't know how involved she was in the Vietnam era. I was watching to see at the end whether they talked about her anti-Zionism. They didn't. They did talk about her favoring a binational state and cooperating with the Arabs in the development of that region in the early days. A longer segment on her reporting back from Eichmann in Jerusalem, which alienated her from a lot of people because she was critical of Quislings. Not overly, I don't think, but that's my judgment call. It's probably available even without your passport in hand on public media. Keith Harden is back in town in the area now. He's over in Sydney at a bank. I think he had a gig yesterday with Donna Nelson filling in for the somewhat hoarse Kathy Harden, the diva sister of great guitar player. I wonder whether he brought his 12 string, like I've been making a request. Riggs Fest is going on some other things. Check your local listings. Bands and CU Bands and Fans probably has it all. And Painkillers are somewhere at Homer Lake while I'm on the radio at 5 p.m. If you want to get out to the countryside a little bit. A Train, Aaron Wilson at the Garley Art Bar are for Soul on Sunday at 7. Now, that's something I could possibly do. Bring my family Zoom along with it. All right, here I am talking about how little time I have, and that took longer than I thought. So looks like we're only going to hear the Paul Offit section. Oh, I have time for. I had a segment of the Corona Calls episode with Philip Muldery talking to a virologist mainly about measles. Offit says something about measles, I think, in this segment we're going to hear, where he says it's very virulent, but it's also very, very seasonal. So if it sort of dropped off the map, it's because that's the way the virus works. I don't understand it, but he has a lot of interesting things to say, and I think it's so important to look at the betrayal that RFK did to his pivotal vote from the senator and Kennedy from Louisiana, who's a practicing doctor, who supposedly thought he got a commitment that he wasn't going to mess with the advisory committee. Well, he sacked them all and replaced them with people that are discussed in this segment. Betrayal of public health.
Quote, flagrantly.
Diseases defining our times. We have invited on Paul Offit. He is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he's an attending physician in the Division of Infectious Diseases. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure.
I wanted to dive deep into probably the most significant policy decision to come out of this administration since it took office. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. cleaned house at the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. This is the board that works under the umbrella of the CDC that comes up with the recommendations that are almost exclusively actually implemented by the CDC on who should be eligible for what vaccines after they've been approved by the FDA. Their recommendations, as I understand it, largely govern what vaccinations insurance plans will pay for, and also what vaccinations will be paid for by government programs like the Vaccines for Children program, which is responsible for immunizing a massive amount of poorer children in this country. Maybe you could start out by walking us through what the status quo ante was like for this body. What kind of person would serve on the commission? What type of work would they do there?
Right, so the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, which advises the CDC regarding when a vaccine is licensed, who should receive it, is composed of experts in the field. So people who have an expertise in virology, immunology, bacteriology, statistics, epidemiology, and more importantly, that those who take care of patients and who often interact with people regarding trying to explain vaccines, and people who have seen vaccine-preventable diseases. So that wealth of expertise was could be found in those 17 people. And when Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired them on the false premise that they were all deeply in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry, which independent investigations have shown wasn't true.
Let's talk about who he has replaced them with. I'm not sure where to start here. There's some of the most prominent vaccine denialists of the COVID years, like Dr. Robert Malone, are on this list, but also a lot of people who don't have clear qualifications for serving on the committee in terms of their professional credentials. Who's most concerning to you?
Right, you're right. We've taken a giant step backwards in terms of the advice that we're getting. Many people have contacted me and others talking about trying to create essentially a parallel ACIP, which consists of people whose expertise you trust and whose recommendations you would trust. The person who worries me the most, I would say, is Robert Malone. He's credentialed in the sense that he's a medical doctor. He has extensive experience even publishing on mRNA back in the late 1980s. But he's a conspiracy theorist who has testified in front of Congress and claimed that mRNA vaccines cause cancer, that they cause heart disease, that they cause autoimmune disease. He has testified on behalf of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in a lawsuit against Merck regarding the mumps component of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. So he's exactly the kind of person you would have expected Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to pick. Someone who, like him, is an anti-vaccine activist, a science denialist, and a conspiracy theorist.
And has managed to reach a very large platform with this. He went on Joe Rogan's podcast, which was a matter of enormous controversy because of its reach. Prompted a kind of half-hearted apology after the fact from Rogan. He's also made kind of wild claims, like he claims to have invented mRNA vaccines, not just to have published one or two papers in the field in an earlier phase of his career.
Well, so he, in the late 80s, published papers in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS, which is certainly a reputable journal, showing that if he took messenger RNA and added it to cells in a dish, say mammalian cells in a dish, or injected mice with it, that messenger RNA could enter cells and make a protein. And then he predicted correctly that this could be used as a drug or it could be used as a vaccine. So that is true. That was important work. But he certainly didn't invent the vaccine, because there were two critical things that had to happen for which he had nothing to do with. The messenger RNA itself can be very much pro-inflammatory, meaning induce an innate immune response, which could not ever work as a vaccine. So what Drew Weissman did and Katie Carrico did, starting in their collaboration in 1997, was they altered the messenger RNA to eliminate that sort of pro-inflammatory response. And then you had to put it in the lipid nanoparticle, because otherwise it would be destroyed before it ever got to the cell. And that was work done by others. So he certainly didn't invent a vaccine. He did do important work early on. So I don't know what happened to Robert Malone over time, but he's clearly gone over to the dark side.
Does he make money from being on the dark side?
Yes, this is the place you want to be if you want to make money. The misinformation business, the disinformation, is much, much better as a business than the information business. I mean, it is estimated that there's about $1 billion made online in the misinformation business. He has a Substack that supposedly makes up to $30,000 a month. He does great.
Let's go through some of the other names that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has just put on the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. There is a PhD, not medical doctor, PhD doctor named Relsif Levy, who has apparently published studies purporting to link COVID vaccine deployment in Israel to an increase in cardiac events there and cardiomyopathy. What do we know about him, and what do we know about that research?
Well, we know that research was methodologically flawed, and therefore it was roundly condemned because it was uninterpretable. I mean, there are about 8,000 studies published a day in the world's literature. So they follow, as you would imagine, a bell-shaped curve. Some are excellent, some are awful, most are more or less mediocre. This falls under the category of awful. You can get anything published. And he proves that by publishing that paper, that bogus notion that the mRNA vaccines were causing heart attacks or sudden death. And that sort of got put out there as, you know, young athletes are dying of COVID vaccines, which was completely wrong. And subsequent studies showed that that was wrong. But it's really hard once you sort of ring the bell to unring it. Once you've scared people, it's hard to unscare them. And that's why he's on this committee, because he, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is perfectly willing to publish and stand behind bad science. And, you know, RFK Jr. always says, I want gold standard science. Show me the good science. But what he really means by that is science that confirms his fixed, immutable notion that vaccines are doing far more harm than good. And regarding COVID vaccines, RFK Jr. has said the COVID vaccines are the most dangerous vaccine ever made. So obviously, he's going to put people on this committee who have beliefs that conform to his.
Another name from the list of new members of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, Martin Kulldorff, another PhD, not medical doctor, biostatistician, apparently fired from Harvard for refusing to get vaccinated back when employers were doing COVID vaccination mandates. He had also co-authored the Great Barrington Declaration early in the pandemic, which was, as I understand it, a manifesto to bunker up the old and vulnerable people and just let the virus rip through the rest of the population. What do we know about him, and what is the medical community's view of the Great Barrington Declaration with the benefit of hindsight?
Well, with the benefit of hindsight, it wasn't such a good idea. I mean, while it is true that the people who are older, especially people over 75, are at highest risk of being hospitalized and dying from this virus, there are also other groups at high risk. So pregnant people are at high risk. People who are immune compromised are at high risk. People who have certain medical conditions like diabetes, obesity, chronic lung or heart or kidney or liver disease are all at high risk. And so, and everybody's at some risk. And so, for example, I mean, there's been about probably 1,800 children who died during this pandemic just in the last year. There were roughly 7,000 children less than 18 years of age who were hospitalized with this virus. One in five went to the intensive care unit. Virtually all were unvaccinated. Half were previously healthy, and 152 died. So everybody's at some risk. So therefore, everybody at some level benefited initially from the primary series. That's certainly true. And so I think the Great Barrington Declaration is sort of just let this virus rip through the community. Therefore, we'll all be naturally infected and protected because natural infection is protective, and that's true. The problem with natural infection is surviving it. I mean, I think that natural immunity should be replaced by the term survivor immunity, because that would be more accurate. The other thing Kulldorff did was he too, like Robert Malone, served as a expert witness on behalf of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in a lawsuit against Merck for Gardasil, which is the human papillomavirus vaccine that prevents head and neck and anal and genital and cervical cancers. And so he too is perfectly willing to sign on to the misinformation business, disinformation business, which is a really good business.
I mean, the HPV vaccine, from what I understand, is an uncontroversial, unmitigated success at dropping rates of cervical cancer, which, like, kills people young. It's a horrible cancer.
Right. About 30,000 cases of cancer a year, two-thirds in women, one-third in men, and again, head, neck, anal, and genital cancers and cervical cancer. That vaccine, which came onto the market in 2008, has since caused more than a 60% reduction in the incidence of cervical cancer, which would kill a few thousand women every year. So it's been an unmitigated success. But again, as far as anti-vaccine activists are concerned, there is no such thing as a beneficial cancer. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., when he was on Lex Fridman's podcast in 2023, said exactly that. No vaccine is a benefit. That comment struck Lex Fridman as a surprise. He said, well, how about the polio vaccine? To which Robert F. Kennedy Jr. responded, that vaccine, the polio vaccine, killed, and I quote, many, many, many more people than it saved. He is a virulent anti-vaccine denialist. He is now the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And know this, he will do everything he can to make vaccines less available, less affordable, and more feared. And if he stays in that position for 4 years, the vaccine infrastructure will dramatically be frayed and our children will suffer.
So some of the Kennedy appointees to this committee don't really have, that I could find, a discernible history of anti-vax work, but they also don't have discernible qualifications for being on an advisory committee about vaccines. Dr. Joseph Hibbelm, he's a psychiatrist, he's a nutritional neuroscientist. What would someone like him be doing on a committee like this in the first place?
All right. He would best be served on a dietary advisory committee. I mean, he brings no specific expertise to the discussions that they're about to have regarding vaccines.
All right. Given the new composition of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, what kind of damage can it do? Like, what's a worst case scenario for this committee now?
I think they're going to follow Project 2025, which if you look under the CDC section, it says that they want to make it so that the CDC no longer recommends vaccines, in part because when the CDC recommends a vaccine, for example, measles-containing vaccine, that means technically that a state could choose to mandate it as part of a school requirement, a school entry requirement. And so you're already seeing evidence for that. When RFK Jr. said that he didn't want to recommend the COVID vaccine for healthy young children, the CDC ultimately just largely to save the vaccine so that it could still be covered for the Vaccine for Children's program and still arguably be covered by insurance, said that this would be shared clinical decision-making between the physician and the patient. And that's where I see things heading. I see things heading where they no longer recommend vaccines, that they just make it, you know, you can get it if you want, which is a way of saying it's not that important. Because if you're saying, you know, that you can have a reasonable discussion with your physician and choose to get it or not, what you're saying is that no vaccine is that important. I think that's where they're heading. And I think they ultimately will do things to alter the Vaccine for Children's, not the Vaccine for Children's program and the Vaccine Injury Compensation program to basically enrich himself, RFK Jr., and his personal injury lawyer friends. That was the question Elizabeth Warren asked during that second confirmation hearing in front of the HELP committee, when she said, you can enrich yourself by just doing what you've been doing, because he sues pharmaceutical companies for a living. That's what he's been doing. And he's being asked at that committee to give it up, and he wouldn't give it up. He can alter things so that now vaccines will be much more subject to litigation, which will drive them off the market. That's what I fear the most. I think, because I lived through the 1980s, when in 1980, we had 18 companies that made vaccines, and then due to basically frivolous litigation, by the end of the decade, there were four left. It's a fragile market. Make it onerous enough to make vaccines, and these companies will leave it.
Yeah, if you're a pharmaceutical company, there's not a lot of profit margin in manufacturing a shot that like is administered once per lifetime and then done. You'd much rather have an expensive pill that someone has to take daily.
Exactly right. You'll never compete. Vaccines will never compete with lipid-lowering agents or psychiatric drugs or neurological drugs, because just for the reason you said, they're something that's given once or a few times in a lifetime.
We're speaking to Dr. Paul Offit. He's director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he's an attending physician in the Division of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Swartzberg, who's normally with us in this time slot, is off this week and next week traveling with his wife. So, Dr. Offit, I hadn't thought before about the policy dimensions of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. snacking the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, that this isn't just about what vaccines insurance companies will pay for, but what vaccination school districts and states and counties can require. It sounds like it's a retreat from public health as a matter of policy. All health becomes a matter of individual choice now.
Right. I think that's what the medical freedom movement is all about. It's freedom to do what I want. And, you know, when we talk about public health, we talk about how we're all in this together. But the medical freedom movement, at least if you look at vaccines, it's my right whether or not I want to catch or transmit a potentially fatal infection. So if you're in the midst of a measles epidemic, for example, as people were in West Texas a couple months ago, people would say, look, it's my right to get a vaccine or not. But, you know, it doesn't just affect you. If you step on a rusty nail and you go to the doctor and the doctor cleans it out and recommends a tetanus vaccine and you say, I don't want to get a tetanus vaccine, no one's going to catch tetanus from you. It's not a contagious disease. But that's not true of something like measles, for example, where the contagiousness index, meaning how many people would you infect during a typical day, assuming you have the disease and assuming everybody you come in contact with is susceptible, is somewhere between 15 and 18 people. And so you're making a decision for others. And is that yours to make?
I mean, this is a somewhat fraught question and has been throughout the history of inoculation and immunization campaigns in this country and elsewhere, because it requires a balancing act between individual freedom and collective well-being.
Right. Now, if you ask, I remember Barbara Fisher, who's founded what at the time was called Dissatisfied Parents Together in the early 80s, which became the National Vaccine Information Center, which is really the first of the major anti-vaccine groups. And she was always lobbying against vaccines and claiming false or bogus claims about vaccine safety. She was asked very early on, what do you want? And she would say, I just don't want vaccines to be mandated. Let us make decisions ourselves. It's a sort of major anti-public health move. The moment to me that was probably the most emotional was in California, had a 2014-2015 measles epidemic. It started in Southern California. It spread to 25 other states. There were hundreds of cases even spread into Mexico and Canada. And so Richard Pan was a pediatrician by training, but he was a state senator. And he wanted to eliminate the philosophical exemption in a state that didn't have a religious exemption. So therefore, you would only have medical exemptions left. And the anti-vaccine people were there in force, lobbying every day against this. It's called Senate Bill 277. So there was a little boy who was 7 years old. His name was Rhett Crowett. And he would go to these meetings. He had leukemia. And he would stand up on a stool so that he could reach the microphone. And he would say, you know, my name is Luke. I have leukemia. I can't be vaccinated. I depend on you to protect me. And then looking right at the people who were there arguing for medical freedoms, he said, don't I count? He, to me, was the voice of society.
And despite the contentious hearings, Dr. Pan prevailed in that legislative battle. The exemptions for children matriculating into Californian schools were drastically narrowed. The vaccinated share of the school-age population went up quite a bit, and we haven't seen a comparable measles outbreak since.
Right, and this was in the 1970s. We had all states had school entry requirements by 1981. But in the 1970s, there were massive outbreaks of measles, you know, tens of thousands of cases. And then with school mandates in place and with the two-dose vaccine and with sort of enforcing that, we eliminated those. And we eliminated the most contagious human infection, measles, by the year 2000 for those reasons. But now you're seeing an erosion in vaccine rates. And as always, is always true, measles is the first disease to come roaring back.
Although we still technically have status as a country that has eliminated measles, I gather it would take sustained transmission within the country from 1 year to the next to lose that designation from the World Health Organization.
That's true, although pre-vaccine, before the first measles vaccine in 1963, measles is a winter-spring disease. So what'll happen is, I suspect, is that the cases will start to come down and then come back up again next November, December. That's what happened to us in Philadelphia in 1991 when we had 1,400 cases of measles and 9 deaths in that city over a few-month period. And we did everything. We isolated, quarantined, we vaccinated down to 6 months of age. And what stopped that particular outbreak was May. I mean, once we got to late May, it stopped circulating. So I think I am sure this is going to be back again next year. And in a sense, measles does come into the country all the time because measles is common in the world. There's millions of cases. There's hundreds of thousands of deaths every year of measles in the world. And now with our backing away from Gavi, the Global Alliance Vaccine Initiative, where we helped vaccinate the world against measles, I think measles will only take off even more in the world. So all of us are going to remain susceptible. We'll see. I do think we're on the verge of losing that status, though.
I see. The pullout from Gavi, that increases the number of measles cases abroad that travelers might be exposed to and bring an infection back home with.
That's right. Or just people traveling from other countries coming to visit the United States.
Sure. I want to turn to something you alluded to earlier, which is the crisis this poses for a lot of people individually. The CDC is, among many other things, a source of reliable, clearly communicated information to the public about how to navigate infectious disease threats. Like, how should our listeners be responding to guidance from the CDC now? Where else can they turn to for advice on what vaccinations to get and when?
So you don't have a CDC director. You don't have a CDC acting director. So the functional director of the CDC right now is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I think any reasonable person can look at the CDC now with skepticism, wondering whether if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. can basically do what he did, which is just put his foot on the neck of the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices and stock it with the kind of people who, like him, are science denialists. Then what happens to, you know, to the CDC in terms of their ability to do the kind of surveillance we need, to the kind of assessments that we need, have the money to do immunization clinics in areas at high risk? I think I am sure there are people at the CDC who feel they are now working at a place where there's been a tremendous lack of trust, that people are looking at the CDC with skepticism, and understandably so. I think we are in a really tough place right now in this country, and I really wish that Congress would stand up and do what's right for the American public and replace Robert F. Kennedy Jr. with somebody who is actually going to represent the public's health.
Mm. All right. Dr. Paul Offit, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he's an attending physician in the Division of Infectious Diseases.
And that's Brian Edwards Tikrit from Upfront. It's actually from a show called Corona Calls, which is part of his Upfront archives, but it's available separately. Somebody, a friend of mine, posted on Facebook about Kennedy's hijinks. He didn't even go to the Vaccine Alliance Gavi, the international body. He sent a video where he cast doubt on diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines. So, despicable. It was held in London, and yeah, he didn't even go to say he wasn't going to help pay for 1 billion children to be vaccinated. Yeah, around the world. Opinions you hear, those of the speakers. You know, I do agree about fluoride in the water, you know, but to take it out without offering a comprehensive dental care for children, fluoride treatments, instead of putting it in the water, that would be a good idea. But he doesn't offer that. He just says, let's just take it out. And he actually was involved in important environmental cases before, I guess, the worm got in his head or something. I don't know. He was involved in the lawsuit that shut down the last reactor in New York. which they're talking about reviving, despite the fact that it's brittle, subject to cracking. Oh, well, I'm doing my channeling of Harry Shearer here, cultural icon that I do know about a little bit. But my name is Paul Muth. I'm transitioning now from News from Neptune, show with Chomsky in mind, Manufacture of Consent. It's one of his major books. If you want to go back through the archives for your summer reading, we have to do a little, we want to do a little underwriting announcement. And we'll get to that. It's about hair care. There's an Airshifter training class tomorrow. I don't know if you can still get aboard on that, but you could write programming@weft.org and inquire. It says walk-in welcomes right at the top of the page. So you can do it if you're a paid member. You wouldn't have to. You can